Hello, you're listening to the Civil Service Pride On podcast. 26th of April is Lesbian Visibility Day, so the Civil Service LGBT Plus Network have been hearing from LGBT Plus women from across the Civil Service. We have been discussing increasing visibility and support in the workplace, as well as considering any barriers LGBT Plus women have faced throughout their careers along with the impact of COVID-19. My name is Leah, one of the Network Vice Chairs, and I will be your host today. On this episode, our guest will be Kirsty, who is a Deputy Director at the Department for Transport. Hello, Kirsty, and thank you for joining today on our podcast. Hopefully, we can cover a lot of topics today on issues around gender and sexuality in the work.
Cool. Well, thanks for having me.
So, to start with, and to find out a little bit more about you, can you tell me about your current job role as Deputy Director at the Department for Transport?
I am a DD in DFT. I'm currently working in the corporate delivery group, doing shareholding for some of the companies that the department sponsors. That generally means that I spend a lot of time working with the boards of companies like High Speed Rail, London Continental Railways, Crossrail International. It's fun, actually, and I've got a lovely team who I work with, and we do things like make sure the company have KPIs, keyboard appointments, that sort of thing.
What previous roles were you in before this role, both within and out of the civil service?
Yeah, did I ever imagine I would grow up to be a shareholding deputy director? No. So I found myself in this role through a little bit of a sort of random career path, actually, one where I sort of followed my interests. So when I left university, I went to work for Volkswagen for a little bit, and that wasn't me. And then I went to work for Oxfam and did a bit of campaigning, and that wasn't really me. But I did always want to be a civil servant. So I eventually did get a job in what was then the Office of the Deputy Prime Minister, which was John Prescott back in the day. But then from there, sort of went through sort of corporate, local government, joined the High Speed Rail team in 2015 in DFT, went back to sort of a mishmash of local government and HS2 in the City and a growth unit, and then eventually found myself settled in corporate finance, which is where I started doing shareholding. And then through various machinery of government changes, I am now in the newly formed as of this year, shareholding and corporate sponsorship directorate, working for a guy called Nathan Phillips, who is a pretty inspirational and out director in the civil service. And it's the second time I've worked with Nathan. So it's a really lovely place to be, and also, I think, an environment in which we all are encouraged to be ourselves.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. How are you finding being a deputy director as a woman and an LGBT woman?
Those are lots of labels, and ones that I don't necessarily think about every day. How do I find being a DD? Honestly, I find the SCS, it's really different to being non-SCS in some way. I think there's an awful lot more around sort of corporate responsibility. I find sort of leadership of a team and an agenda and that sort of SCS sideways role, sort of being one big corporate leadership, is a really big step up. And for some people, it's really enjoyable. For others, it might feel a bit alien. But I think it must be really hard for people who come in from outside the civil service, actually. But it's great. You know, I would say that I probably struggle a little bit as a woman in what I do because I work with a lot of men. The nature of transport and infrastructure is it tends to be a very male-dominated, men over a certain age as well. And as much as they are all lovely individuals, when you find yourself one of maybe the only woman in the room or one of maybe two or three, time and time again, I do actually find that quite tricky. But I take a bit of inspiration from our perm sec, Bernadette. She's also the Civil Service Social Mobility Champion, and she's a really sort of down-to-earth, grounded person who absolutely holds her own and bosses well, and I think it's pretty inspirational, actually. So there's a little bit of me always just tries to do a bit of Bernadette when I find myself in those situations. But being gay is it's probably the last bit of me that I sort of wear a badge about at work, because as with anybody, you know, your sexuality is not necessarily something people will know about you. It's something you're constantly sort of facing that choice about whether to share and whether or not to share it. I'll admit I don't always rush to put myself out there or out myself in every situation, but having become a mum in the last 6 months to an absolutely awesome little girl called Violet, who is the sassiest little human I've ever met, I am increasingly realizing that actually that should not be a choice. That should be a badge I wear front and center. And not doing so does not create an environment for my daughter that I want to create. So doing this podcast is one of the steps I'm taking to be a much more visible, vocal, proud individual.
Amazing. And just to pick up on what you've said there, do you ever feel like you have to challenge stereotypes in work, being in a more male-dominated space?
I think there are different leadership styles that are dominant depending on which bit of civil service you're working in. And sometimes those are given male and female attributes. But to be honest, I think it's more about culture. I've met some people who are women who are probably the most masculine in the way that they will manage situations and lead. They will be the people stamping their hand on the table going, but I want this done now. And you know, things that people would typically in a sort of retrospect way, a retroactive sort of way, say it's quite a masculine trait. Actually, I've seen women be those people probably more than a lot of men. And some of that might be about women overcompensating in what is quite a male-dominated environment. But I think it's more about culture. And actually what I quite like about the transport sector, and I think this is pushed by the Leadership Council, I think this is pushed by some really big influential employers like High Speed 2, who are the only platinum rated D&I organisation in the public sector. And actually projects that we don't sponsor, like Thames Tideway or and back in the day Crossrail, you know, they are pushing a culture of collaboration and trying to modernise construction infrastructure. And I think with that come a lot more jobs in areas like green engineering, digital, bringing innovation into things. And it just over time, we'll just see more and more women enter those sectors. But they don't have the same labels. They don't create the same barriers mentally for people.
What would your advice be to a woman considering a more male-dominated profession?
So first of all, why do you think it's a male-dominated profession might be a question to ask a woman, and why should that be a problem? I think that sort of imposter syndrome, or reinforcing imposter syndrome in people, or internalised homophobia actually, which I think sometimes holds some people back, I think those are more dangerous concepts than whether a job has traditionally been something a man or a woman would do. First of all, sort of do a bit of challenge yourself to not limit yourself. More generally and more practically, I would advise people to think about how these projects are going to transform the country and how they are going to evolve over time. You know, if we take High Speed Rail as an example, yes, there's an awful lot of digging and tunnelling going on right now, but actually it's probably the biggest innovation that's going to be invested in Europe over the next 25 years. It's you can go into that organisation now as a relatively junior person and know that it's a railway that's going to be built out into the late 2030s. And you can plot a career in an organisation like that. You can have a future that's really quite amazing, doing things that you never thought you were going to do, you know, end up running something like station design for one of the phase two stations. People going into the organisation this year will have those opportunities. It's really exciting, actually, transport infrastructure. I get pretty excited by it, but much to the dismay of all of my family and friends who are a little bit like, can we talk about something else now?
It's good to be passionate about your job. Touch on something else that you covered before. So you're trying to do more to be more of a visible LGBT woman in work. What more do you think there needs to be done to improve that visibility by networks and by other LGBT women?
I think it is important that people share their experiences and are visible. So, you know, it was great that you guys approached me to do this. It gave me an opportunity to walk that talk, but more people need to do it. I think I'm very, you know, I'm obviously very lucky. My director is an out and proud gay man, but I'm not sure I could point to any other directors in Whitehall who I know to be out and proud. I think he's probably the only one I know of. So actually, I'd encourage more people, particularly at more senior levels, to come out and be visible. I think also, I was asked a question last year, in Pride Month, where we did a staff event, and someone said to me, what is the thing that we can all do to be active allies? And I said, well, you know, the thing is, I think quite often people are scared to offend, and so you will sort of skirt around an issue like someone's sexuality, even if you've heard on the grapevine or you know that someone's got a partner that's of the same sex, people will typically come to the bit where it's, oh, tell me about yourself. Do you have a husband or wife? And they will start with a heteronormative framework and then work towards saying, I'm liberal and open-minded. And yeah. And actually, I find what that does, and I quite a few people messaged me after I said this and said, oh, I hadn't really thought of it like that. So, but what that does is it puts the onus, responsibility, and the emotional charge onto the individual who's got to answer the question. Because what you're saying is, instead of this just being a chit-chat where you can make a throwaway comment about a partner and we can laugh about whether they put the bin out because that's what the joke's really about, I've suddenly put you in a position where you have to come out. And coming out I think it requires quite a lot of trust. I think it requires me to feel safe in that moment and with that person in a way that just throwing away a comment like, oh, well, Charlotte and I, you know, we take it in turns to take the bin out, or actually Charlotte's never taken the bin out, which is, by the way, the truth. And I always end up taking the bin out because I break first. I can't just make that comment and it be a comment on its own. So I think there's a bit of, I would like people to bring a bit of emotional intelligence and not be scared to offend by saying, so do you have a partner? Not starting from a heteronormative framework for that.
Do you feel like you have to continuously come out at work?
I do, actually, because my team, though, and I'm very open with my team, but particularly having had Violet, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, well, how old is she? And I'll say she's under 6 months. People are like, oh, you didn't take very long off. And so they all assume I've had a baby. Mm-hmm. And then I go, I'm not taking maternity leave. My partner is. And then they all go, oh, right, okay. And they all look very perplexed by it. And it doesn't make sense to them. So then I have to go, so Charlotte carried Violet, and sort of say it that way. And then I watch the penny drop. Mm-hmm. And then what nine times out of 10 happens, and I find this isn't a criticism, but I do find this really disappointing, is I can almost see in their eyes the process that takes place in their brain, where I am then put into the box of dad. And there's nothing wrong with being dad. You know, dads are great. My dad's great. I'm not saying that I'm offended to be classed as such, but being a dad is a very different thing to being a mum. And I happen to be a mum. And I find it quite, you know, I find I'm having to out myself all the time at the moment because I'm telling people about my daughter. But I said at the top of this, I think it's really important that I do that. And I don't just choose to sort of brush it to one side and let people think what they want to think, because I don't want her growing up thinking at any point I was ashamed to just say who I am and the situation of our family. I want her to be unapologetic about having two mums and to not feel that I am telling her it's something that she needs to hide. And, you know, you never know. She, whatever she chooses or however her own sexuality ends up being for her and however she identifies, hopefully if we create that environment around us, that will help her feel very, very proud about who she is.
Yeah. What would you recommend colleagues did to be better allies to prevent that awkward and uncomfortable conversation for you each time you kind of talk about your daughter?
I mean, what I've said already about people not being heteronormative in their sort of approach to things or trying to challenge themselves not to be. I think it's just as important to not be gendered in the way we approach things as well. Particularly, you know, opportunities like International Women's Day is a moment for us to reflect on do we need to stereotype jobs as male and female, or do we need to talk about what career opportunities there are for people irrespective of their gender? In the same vein, you know, we should approach our colleagues as people who have lives outside of work and respect those lives irrespective of what shape they take. But I suppose more generally, you know, get involved with the staff networks and support the groups that you know exist nearby and debate things, talk about things. I think the worst thing colleagues can do is not talk about something because they're scared of saying the wrong thing. I think if it comes from a place of kindness and there's no bigotry intended or anything like that, then people will forgive people for using the wrong phrases. It's about communication, isn't it?
Definitely. So are you part of any LGBT plus or women networks yourself?
I am, but I will confess I've only recently joined them. And this is all part of the, if Violet's going to be in my life, I need to make sure I'm the best possible mom I can be. And so I'm trying to be more active about the things I say I stand for. So I have joined the DFT LGBT group and become a BAME ally. And I've joined the Families Network. And I spoke earlier this week at the cross-government gender network event. So I'm trying very hard, but I won't proclaim to have been a lifelong participant in all of these things. Very honestly, I'm coming to the party too late. So I encourage everybody else to do it. But, there's no such thing as too late necessarily, but I perhaps should have done it sooner.
Is there anything that was stopping you joining previously?
Busy. I'm just too busy. I'm one of those people who, got 1,000 things going on. Actually, that's quite selfish because I think I do, coming back to what I was saying about the sort of wider leadership of being in the SCS, I think I have a responsibility actually to be more visible and to say to other people it's okay. But it wasn't until I was in a situation with my daughter that I sort of realised that those things aren't there for everyone. So I think I was perhaps just a little bit selfish, a bit naive and busy before.
Do you think that COVID has had an impact on women in the workplace?
Absolutely. I think COVID's impact on the workplace is something we will be studying and coming to terms with for generations, actually. I keep thinking about, this is going to sound really random, but I keep thinking about Bletchley Circle, an ITV programme about women who had been decoders and cipher engineers during World War II, and it sort of traces their lives after the war, and that sort of what happened to them. So there's a sort of call to arms moment during COVID. Personally, I was moved into a different job. I spent 6 months working on a freight task force in the department. It was really intense, long hours, high profile work. I sort of got spat out at the end of it when we came out of lockdown in sort of late summer, which was around the time Violet was born, and then took some time off work because she'd been born. And when I came back to my normal job, which is the job I introduced everyone to. There's a bit of me sort of going, wow, I'm still processing some of those experiences and some of, how I felt in some of those situations. I came back to a world where I was sort of like, and then around, I was surrounded suddenly by people who had become primary carers. Not all women, by the way. Actually, two guys in my team became homeschool experts. One of them enjoyed it more than the other. Definitely, there is a guy who I will call Mark. It's not his real name. But I protect his identity. He's basically like, I'm just so frustrated. I thought he was really clever, but he can't even tell the time. And I feel for him. He's learning how to be a teacher, and then he sort of clocks off doing that, and then at 1 o'clock he starts being a civil servant again and doing stuff that he's like, this is the light relief, this is what I know how to do. So learning he becomes the primary carer, but my experience with Mark is a bit unusual, because actually I look across the wider directorate and wider CDG and I predominantly is women, and that is something about our society that hasn't changed very much, really, and I think COVID's really brought that to light. I think those constraints on your time, are you available to see that last minute call at 6:30 with somebody more senior? Are you able to do something over the weekend or in the evenings because it needs to be done quickly? I don't think it's deliberate, and I think lots of attempts have been made to combat what that might mean for people in terms of career opportunities, and I do not fault the leadership of my department at all when I say this, but the reality is some people get an opportunity to shine in those situations, some people don't. So I think the short answer is COVID has absolutely impacted women disproportionately to men, and we know there's lots of statistics that say that and lots of data and lots of people's stories that also corroborate that it's had a disproportionate impact on people from lower socioeconomic groups. Do not identify as white predominantly, and it's impacted at different ages in different ways. What we've got to make sure we do is we learn from it, and we are very conscious about what we do next as we get to a new normal, and that's quite an exciting period actually, because we're designing a workspace for the future and we don't have to be tied to the conventions of the past, and hopefully we can create a working environment and a culture for ourselves that makes it easier for men to be primary carers and makes it easier for women who are primary carers not to miss out on opportunities. You know, I'd like to think we could do that, but to do that, we need to do it really consciously, and we probably need to do some proper soul searching about how we work. I'm really excited that we're talking about programmes like Places for Growth, and that so many departments have talked about moving headquarters out of London, that we're having debates about how many days a week people go back to the office as opposed to whether people just go back to how we used to be, that we've got the technology that allows us to do things differently. You know, one of the silver linings of Teams, as much as it sort of, you know, can tear my hair out some days, is that actually there's no constraint on how many people can go into the room, the virtual room. And so more junior members of my team have sat in on meetings that they wouldn't have a year ago been able to participate in because the meeting room wouldn't have been big enough. What a rubbish excuse. But, you know, how many times have you heard people say, I can't fit anybody else in the room? Or it just wouldn't have felt, it would have changed the dynamic, so fewer people would have been invited. Whereas if you're doing it online, it's a much more equal playing field. And it's more about, you know, getting people into a discussion at the right time to save on time later. So if we can bottle those experiences and take them with us into the next steps, brilliant. And let's also not be tied to the conventions of the past. Coming back to your original question, COVID absolutely has exposed lots and lots of things that need to be tackled.
It's interesting how you say you've been quite busy the last year. You've got a lot of job priorities and obviously a new responsibility at home as well, but you've also found more time to actually dedicate towards being a senior LGBT woman, to actually dedicate time to that as well.
I'm trying to. I think reality is people like you make it easier for me to do those things because you create these platforms. I think if I had to find the technology, work out how to use it, record myself, get someone to interview me and put something out into the world all by myself, I probably wouldn't do it because, you know, that's a lot of work and probably not my skill set. But participating in things doesn't take that much time. And actually, I think I've come to realise that's such a poor excuse for me not doing these things sooner. There are really active networks out there. There are people like you, Leah. There are people like Rob Bullock in DFT, who's an absolute campaigner, advocate, pioneer, inspiration to people, who, you know, has rang me up on more than one occasion and said, it's really important that you do stuff like this. And he's absolutely right. And so here I am doing these things. And I'm really pleased you test people like me. And hopefully you'll help more people do it. Because I suspect what happens is, a bit like me, people are just being a bit lazy.
I suppose you've got to be able to see the things in the right place as well, to find them as well.
And obviously there will be some people for whom they're just not comfortable doing this sort of thing. And, you know, I don't judge them harshly for that. You've got to do what makes you comfortable. Yeah. But I just needed a nudge.
I think you've probably touched on a little bit already. So how do you think COVID has impacted on LGBT plus people and families differently to others?
So this is my perception, and not necessarily everyone will agree with it. But I think as a community, we're used to being visible, being virtual, being hidden, being a community that's very physical. Like over the years, if you think about sort of socio-economic history of the LGBT community, I think we're pretty resilient, actually. When I moved to London, it was all about, you know, there'd be loads of cafes spread out across London or bars, and you'd sort of go and that's how you'd meet people and how you build your friendship group and how you'd get involved in things. And, you know, I remember, I think when I first moved to London in the early 2000s, I had a book that I carried around with me that had a sort of list of all the places you could go to that were considered community hubs. Obviously, you know, most of those closed, then it became a very concentrated Soho scene, and then lots of things have closed, and now my view is that there are very few venues that are dedicated to the community, but there are nights at venues that are much more crossover that exist, and just that sort of like that social scene actually is a bit of a sort of metaphor for, I think, how as a community we probably all adapted to COVID, which is pretty resilient. And if we have to live online, we'll live online. And if we need to bunker down at home, we will bunker down at home. But we're probably all chomping at the bit to get back out and see each other once the lockdown lifts. I don't pretend to know what anybody else's situation is like. Personally, my lockdown experience has been frustrating and tiresome in many ways, but full of silver linings and blessings. Like working from home whilst having a baby has been incredible for me. And touch wood, I'm fortunate that my experience of COVID hasn't involved any close family members or friends being really, really heavily impacted by it. That's not necessarily the case for everybody, and for anybody whose situation is different, I'm nothing but sympathy and empathy. I hope you guys are okay. But I just can't wait to get back out, go to the park, go to the park. I've been going to the park for a year. Go to a museum. That's going to be lovely. Take my daughter to a museum. That's what I'm looking forward to.
Well, hopefully you'll be able to do that soon, and I'll be looking out for more.
That's it for today's episode. Thank you for listening. Thank you again to Kirsty for joining us today. We hope that you have enjoyed all our recent podcast episodes and blogs for both International Women's Day and Lesbian Visibility Day. If you're not already, you can subscribe to this podcast on all mainstream platforms. You can find out more about the Civil Service LGBT Plus Network, including news and events, on our website at civilservice.lgbt. For all our latest updates, you can also follow us on Twitter at CSLGBT, on Instagram at CivilServiceLGBT, or you can visit facebook.com/CivilServiceLGBT. Until next time, thank you for listening.